Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop mechanic and promise to let it live if it tells us what we want to know. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host today is Sam Roberts. My new game, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, is still on Kickstarter. It's a melodramatic action game of bloody revenge. It's a one-shot capsule game, box set, deck builder RPG. And today, I am once again joined by Sam Roberts to talk about it. You might remember him from the episode we did on prestige classes a couple years ago, from being a fixture on the Dice Exploder Discord, or from his hit PBTA game Escape from Dino Island, co-designed with Sam Tung. This episode is another in a little mini-series I'm doing about the mechanics that influenced me as I was designing Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. Or, at least I say mechanics, but I mean, you've read the episode title by now. We're talking about a movie today. We're talking about John Wick. Because I usually skip all that crap I started with here describing Band-Aids and Bullet Holes and just go with my John Wick game. And I've become increasingly interested in the way people bring all kinds of expectations about the fiction and genre of a game when they sit down to play it at the table. And where do those all come from in this game? It's John Wick, it's Kill Bill, it's maybe a couple other movies, but that's basically it. And it's not just players who are doing this, right? Designers often talk about their games as being genre emulation too. People just love the idea of taking something they love from another medium and making a game engine that allows them to generate more of it. But how do you do that? And what are the important parts of John Wick that you're trying to make more of? What's actually going to give you the feeling you want? And what's just kind of texture? Or is the texture what's important? Is that going to give you the feeling? Here's something Sam said to me right after we finished recording. A good adaptation of a genre or a media property isn't interested in how you feel about the thing now. It's interested in how you felt when you were experiencing it for the first time and what the characters are feeling within the story. Yeah, that's what I want to do. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about how Sam and I did that in our genre games. To get into all that, first we have to talk about the movie, and we spoil the shit out of this thing, especially the first 30 minutes, so heads up if you care about that sort of thing. But let's get into it. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon, and here is Sam Roberts and John Wick. Sam Roberts, welcome back to Dice Exploder. It's good to have you here again.
Great to be here.
So we're not talking about a game today. We're talking about John Wick, which is a movie from 2014 directed by Chad Stahelski. He's a stunt coordinator. He gets promoted. There's a script from Derek Kolstad. I don't know exactly how all this goes down, but they make this movie. It's called John Wick. It comes out. I knew it was an action movie going into it when I saw it in 2014, but I didn't really know anything else about it. And I really want to talk about that feeling versus kind of, I think, what it has become and what people are bringing to John Wick as an identity now. But I want to start by asking you, in 2014, or whenever it was that you first saw John Wick, like, what was that like? Where were you? What was going on?
So it's funny you describe, like, the experience that you described seeing John Wick was my experience seeing The Matrix, another Keanu movie, of just, like, it was a rainy day. We'd seen the Super Bowl trailer, and we went to the movies and sat down, had no idea what we were going to see, and like had our minds blown. So I think Keanu just like has the ability to do that in a way that is underappreciated. He picks good movies. But I saw John Wick after the hype a little bit. I don't think the second one had come out yet. So I don't think it was like the John Wick universe, but I'd heard it was really good. It was out on streaming. I was home alone one night and I was just like, time to watch a dumb action movie. And I mean, John Wick is the perfect dumb action movie. I think there are a lot of people who want John Wick to be something more important than it is, or more like richer, a richer text than it is. And it is just like a perfect dumb action movie. Everyone in it knows what they're doing. Everyone is playing their part perfectly. I love it.
Yeah. I remember, it's funny, I watched Point Break for the first time recently at a revival screening at Vidiot's here in LA, and that also was just like perfect dumb action movie. And I came home and I rewatched Speed, and now we're just like listing Keanu Reeves' perfect action movies, right? And like The Matrix, it does have something more going on, but the rest of those, it's just like, there are all these movies that feel like the platonic ideal of this kind of classic movie, like classic, like cable movie that was always playing on cable when, you know, in the 90s, the 80s, where it's not like any individual thing in the movie is like a home run. It's just like everything about it is pretty fucking good. Like it's just pretty good and there's no mistakes. And like that turns it into this just like all hits, no misses. It's just solid all the way through. Everything builds on everything else. It just stacks up and you never get taken out of it. So it's just like it builds forward until it's just fun. Like this is what the movies are about, right? It's just going and having some fun at the movies. And yeah, I don't know. It's fabulous.
I think about John Wick, what makes it work though, and where a lot of the other, like, you know, because now the joke in Hollywood used to be it's Die Hard, but in a whatever. And it was, you know, instead of in a building, it's Die Hard, but somewhere else. And then suddenly in 2014, it overnight became it's John Wick, but he's a, and it was like, you know, but it's a pig, you know, it's John Wick, but he can't feel pain. It's there's like a John Wick about
it's
everything.
John Wick, but he's a woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think the beauty of John Wick is that I think it knows it's a little campy, but it never leans into the sort of this B movie thing that you're talking about. Like I watched Fight or Flight the other night, which is a Josh Hartnett. It's John Wick, but on a plane.
Yeah.
And I liked it all right. It was a fun way to spend an hour and a half, but there's so many moments in that movie where it's like, oh yeah. And then there's going to be a chainsaw on a plane. Isn't that nuts? And and John Wick never has a moment like that. John Wick is like, we are in the places that these characters would be. These characters are acting the way they would be acting, but it's just, every actor is just playing it to the hilt, but it's very earnest.
There's this classic thing of like, in a comedy, the characters don't know they're in a comedy, right? And so the way you do good comedy is you just like treat it like it's a drama and trust the writing to be funny. And in that same way, it's like what you're saying, the characters in the John Wick movie don't know they're in a John Wick movie, right? It's like, this is just like how life is. This is just, it commits so hard. What you just said that I really have been saying for years about this. You can go back and hear an early episode of Dice Exploder talking with Gem Room Games about Merkborg. We talked about this of like, Merkborg's a comedy game, right? It was sort of our thesis there. And in the same way, like John Wick, like kind of is a comedy, like to some extent, like there's so much in it where it's like, this is so hyper serious that it becomes dumb. Actually, one of my first experiences with it, the trailer had come out and there's the line of Keanu in the trailer saying, you know, everyone keeps asking if I'm back and I haven't really had an answer, but now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back. And I had a friend who just like said that over and over before the movie had come out. And every time he would go, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back. And then he'd like laugh hysterically at the seriousness of the line. And like writing that line is so hard. It's like, it's so, but the movie nails it. It like gets to have its cake and eat it too, of both being so silly and taking it seriously and never, ever breaking.
Well, and that line is such a perfect example because, I mean, what's like, it's the line that gets played like it's like a big beat and it's played like it's like a quip, but there's no quip. It's not a pun. It's like,
yeah, there's no quip. Like
There's no cleverness to the line, right? It's just like there, people are asking me if I'm back and I'm thinking I'm back. And also, by the way, you know, you don't know that when you're watching the trailer, but when I was rewatching the movie in advance of this, I was really surprised to discover that happens like 2/3 of the way through the movie. Like he has murdered many people before he's like, I'm back.
Yeah, that actually transitions really well into what I think is sort of the key to John Wick and why most of the sequels don't really work for me, which is the first 30 minutes, I believe it's 29 minutes. I checked the time code. It's like exactly 29 minutes the fighting starts. But that means you have 29 minutes of like 141 minute runtime of we haven't seen John Wick kill anyone. Like, and for a long part of that, like if you go into this movie totally blind, like it is not clear that this is going to be an action movie until like 10, 12, 15 minutes into the movie. Like let's go through the plot a little bit, right? Like John Wick, he's a guy and his wife dies of cancer. Oh, it's very sad. It's very tropey. And then
wait, I think it's really important that the very first thing you see is that John Wick is like bloodied and dying and looking at a video of his wife. Yeah. Right. And so even if you think that there's going to be some, like, you know, there's going to be some fighting, but like you think he's going to get his ass kicked.
Totally. But so then we cut from him. He's like beat up. He's watching his bloody phone footage of his sad wife on a beach. And then he's just like living his life. He's sad. It's very gray and foggy. He goes to his wife's funeral and Willem Dafoe is there. And they have some sort of interaction that makes you go, ooh, there's history to this world, you know. And then John Wick goes home. He gets delivered a dog. His dead wife has like set up a dog delivery for him so that he will have some creature to love after she is gone. And he takes care of the dog. He takes the dog out to poop. He gives the dog cereal for breakfast because he doesn't have any dog food. He's trying to love this creature, but he doesn't know how. You know, he's working on it. And then he takes his car out and he drives his car around and drives really crazy. He's got a sick car. We can see him doing action stuff, right? It's like, oh, this man, he's sad. He's getting his anger out by doing driving. It's very like, right? There's like a Bob's Burgers episode where there's a kid who's like, I get my feelings out through dancing. And like, that's how it feels watching John Wick like drive this car.
Well, also he drives his car like right up. If I remember correctly, it's like basically he's playing chicken with like it's like an airplane or something. Like he's playing chicken with like an unmoving airplane. And so this, you also know this guy has a death wish. Like the only reason he's alive is because of this dog.
And then on his way home, he's at the gas station, and then some like Russian mobster young punks. They're obviously mobster Russian young punks immediately.
The great shit heel actor Alfie Allen of Game of Thrones, just perfect in this role. Everyone in this movie is perfectly cast.
Oh, so perfectly cast. Yeah. He's like, nice car. How much? And John's like, she's not for sale. And the guy's like, he says in Russian, everything's got a price, bitch. And then John Wick says in Russian back, not this, bitch. And it's like, oh, he speaks Russian. There's more past here. And like, okay, the guys leave. And then that night, the guys come to his house and they take his car and they beat him up and they kill his precious dog. Well, that's the big thing everyone knows about this movie, right? They fucking kill this dog. Very first thing in this movie. And John is like, all right, well, I guess it's time to literally murder all of these people. Like he puts him, we don't see that part yet, but like, you know, kind of know that's coming. He like puts himself back together in the morning.
He cleans up the house, which I love he's so precise. It's like, there's so many great, I think that's part of why this movie works is even though it's so over the top and it's so, so campy, it's like, he cleans up the house and you just see him scrubbing the floor. He takes the collar and he puts it on his nightstand, the dog's collar next to.
Yeah, they rub it in so hard. His dog really died. This is the cutest dog that has ever been on film, too.
It's true.
Yeah. So then we cut to John Leguizamo, who's also perfectly cast in this movie. And he's like at a chop shop, right? He runs a chop shop. And the Russian mobster punks like show up and they're like, hey, we need a new VIN number on this cool new car we just stole. And John Leguizamo is like, where'd you get that car? And then we cut to later John Wick showing up at the chop shop and he walks in and he says to John Leguizamo, is it here? And John Leguizamo takes like 15 seconds to pour himself a drink and pour John a drink before he replies, it was. And then we like intercut John Leguizamo telling John Wick what has happened in the past where he was dealing with the Russian guys, and which is just such a great, like, you need to do the intercutting here just so you can have the moment of like, we don't know what's happened to the car. And John shows up and is like, is it here? And Leguizamo's like, it was. Like that pair of lines is like what John Wick is, right? It's like, that's what makes this movie fucking good, is that shit.
I think in some ways, John Leguizamo was like the heart of this movie.
Yeah.
This is my pitch. I mean, the dog is obviously in some ways the heart of the movie, but the fact, because what happens is he shows up and he punches Alfie Allen in the face.
Yeah.
He punches this Russian brat in the face for doing this stupid thing of stealing John Wick's car. We don't know why yet. And so then John Wick shows up and asks out the car. And John Leguizamo's like, it was here. Or sorry, it was. And then John Wick like has a drink with him and lets him go and leaves. And then John Leguizamo gets a call from the big man, this
The dad of the Russian punk,
who is obviously like a high-powered mobster. It's Michael Nyquist, who is fantastic in this role also. Not Russian, but you believe it.
And this is the heart and soul of the movie for me, is the dialogue that happens on that phone call. Because the Russian mobster calls up Leguizamo and is like, I hear you struck my son. And Leguizamo is like, yeah, well, he stole John Wick's car and killed his dog. And the mobster goes, oh, and hangs up the phone. And that, oh, by itself is just, it's everything. That to me was the moment in this movie where I was like, this is an all-timer movie. It knows exactly what it is. He just says, oh, hangs up the phone, and we know everything we need to know. Like, if we didn't already, it just, the entire movie is in a single syllable. It's so perfect.
It is. And I think the thing that also really landed for me, and the reason I was saying John Leguizamo is the heart of this movie, is because you're saying all of this, and it's true, knowing, you now know where the movie is going. It's hard to not watch that scene, that oh, knowing that like the hell that John Wick is going to unleash. But there's a subtler piece, which is, he also basically is like, okay, John Leguizamo, like I am the mobster who will kill anyone who messes with me. I am like, I have no qualms about hurting people, but like, you're my chop shop guy and you punched my son for a very good reason. And that's cool. Like, I'm fine with that. I'm not going to like, and in a lesser movie, in a different movie, John Leguizamo would get dead just for this crime of messing with this boss. But there's such a code of honor undergirding this whole story. And it becomes really important as it goes on. But this is the first moment where it's like, John Leguizamo, in a very messed up situation, does right by everybody. And everyone lets him walk for that. When like, you know, I feel like you'd watch so many other movies where he'd be dead and it would feel wrong.
You're so right that like the part of the reason everything about the movie is like encapsulated in that oh syllable for me is because it's doing that. It's setting up that code of honor that is going to blow up into this like mythology that then takes over all the sequels. But in this moment, like in this movie, is all about just sort of like underpinning the moral philosophy of the universe that John Wick exists in. So then we get like 10 minutes in here of like dad Russian mobster yelling at his son for having done this, right? And this goes on. The build of this is really good. We get like incredibly like tight scene stuff where the shitty guy from the insurance commercials is his like right hand man. He's just like a guy you want to punch in the face. And he's like, hey, you've successfully taken over the whole underworld. Congratulations. Why do you look so sad? And dad mobster is just like, where's my son? I need to talk to my son. And then immediately starts beating up his own son, right? Like, you punch John Wick, you fucking idiot. You know, like goes over this whole thing. And then you get the like iconic line of like,
and he keeps wanting to get out of the room that his consigliere, what's his name, and he's like no, you stay,
yeah,
you watch me beat up my son.
And then you get the iconic line of like, oh, you're talking about this guy like he's the boogeyman. No, he's not the boogeyman. He's the guy you said to kill the fucking boogeyman. And then you get the like, I once saw him kill three men with a pencil, a fucking pencil. And then he like is walking away and he does this little like like thing to the insurance commercial guy, like he's stabbing him in the neck with a pencil. And it's so over the top, it's so silly, it's so like he's trying to scare his own son. And it's also just straight up exposition, right? It's like, if you didn't get it from before of us underlining the fact that the important thing here is like John Wick has a past, here's his fucking past, this is everything about this man, like everything you need to know. And like, now he's gonna come kill all of us, and that's gonna be the rest of the movie. And like that, and then you get
nothing clever. Again, nothing. There's nothing clever that has happened in the movie up until this point. It is. In fact, there are times where it is like unclever. Like John Wick's code name is Baba Yaga, which is like an old lady witch.
Because it's cool in Russian.
Do they know Russian? I'm not sure. But there's so much integrity to like everybody's reaction. Like, oh, is not a clever line. A fucking pencil is not a clever, it's not even that clever an idea. Like, we've seen the Joker kill somebody with a pencil in The Dark Knight, but it's all like, every single one of these things is acted with like such a such an intensity and clarity of you know what everyone wants, you know what everyone's thinking, and it's just like, it's so pure.
Yeah. And the other incredible moment in there, and I promise we're only going to go through these first like 29 minutes and we're basically done. And then I think we're going to just kind of skip it. And then he kills a bunch of guys and that's the rest of the movie, right? Like that, we'll go from there. But like don't leave the podcast, folks. But the other thing that I love in there is he's like, the dad Russian calls up John, who we're watching John in his basement using a sledgehammer to like dig up all of his old materials, right, from his assassin days. And he's got like a chest full of gold and guns and all this shit. And the like bright red landline in his basement rings, and it's the Russian mobster. And the mobster's just like, "Hey, John, I heard about your wife. Sorry she died. So can we do anything here? Let's not resort to our baser instincts," I think is his line. And throughout this speech, he keeps leaving pauses for John to speak, and John never responds. He's silent for the whole conversation, right? And finally, he's like, "Let's not resort to our baser instincts," and John hangs up on him. And then, like, we're back with the mobster, and he's like, he sighs, he hangs up the phone, and insurance guy is like, "What'd he say?" And the mobster goes, "Enough." And that's a clever line. That's a fucking banger fucking line right there. It's so good. But like, okay, so we've done all that setup. And that, so Russian mobster's like, "Okay, send everyone we have to kill John Wick." We watch like all these guys start to like infiltrate John's house. We see there's like 24 of them or something. And then John Wick kills all of them and just spends the next 100 minutes of the movie killing everyone that he encounters, right? Like, that's the rest of the movie. He just murders everyone. And there's, like, a lot to talk about with the rest of the movie, but, like, to bring us back to something you were saying really early on, like, I think, to me, John Wick is a fantastic movie because these first 29 minutes work so well for the reasons that we've just been talking about, such that when it's time for him to start killing people, it feels like a release. We've had this like buildup where like, what is it going to be like when he starts killing people again? And then it comes and it like lives up to the expectation in our head, and the quality is really good, but we also get to see John get beat up a lot, and like that's interesting. Like we get all this release of the rest of the movie. We're like along for the ride of the cathartic release of the rest of the movie because it did such a good job setting this all up and building the mystery of what is going to happen and like, who is this guy? What's he going to do? And I think
There's also, can I say something? Cause I'm pretty allergic to movies with overlong setups where like, you kind of know where you're going, where I'm like, okay, like his dog's dead. Like he's going to kill the people. Like, let's get to it. Let's get to the killing. Like, let's make the killing the fun part. That's what we're all here for. But I don't think that's true of John Wick. I think John Wick works because actually it's also like, it's kind of a chess match, right? Like, obviously there's building up this emotional thing. You're meeting Willem Dafoe, and so you're like, I'm excited about this because I love Willem Dafoe. Who doesn't love Willem Dafoe? And you're gonna see him later. Like, you know he's gonna come back, so that's juicy. But then like, a lot of this stuff, from the moment he has this interaction with the young mob son, you're like, who's gonna make the next move? How are they going to play it out? And he's paid, you know, they say it, he's very, I hear how he describes him, but it's like, he's patient, he's methodical, he's driven, is how they describe John Wick. And so there's this sense in which, you know, to your description that you just gave of the every single beat that happens in the first half hour of this movie, moment by moment, it's like, you know, they're trying to get out of it, right? Like John Leguizamo was like, how do I play this? The mob boss is like, how do I play this? Even John is a little bit like deciding how he's going to play it, although we kind of know how he's going to play it. But he cleans up. Like there's this like, you have to do things the right way thing to it that makes it all feel like it's building. And it feels like at any moment it could start. And I think that's what's fun about it is your...
Yeah, the tension of it.
Yeah. And it's holding you in that tension, as opposed to just being like, well, we got to make you invest in all these characters by giving them a tragic backstory, because they get through the tragic backstory really fast. That part is all is like over in 3 minutes. And it's all of the this stuff with
the movie is fundamentally uninterested in his tragic backstory. That's why it's the most tropey, like bullshit dead dog wife like backstory of all time. Right. Because the important thing is getting him to the point where he wants to do a revenge.
Right. But it is very interested in earning in convincing you that actually the thing that is going to happen here and that should happen here is that he should absolutely slaughter everyone, right? Like, you know, because you want to in 2014 and even more in 2026, like I remember even watching The Matrix, to go back to my truest favorite Keanu movie, if I'm being honest. There's that scene where they gun everyone down in the hallway, the iconic scene. And you're even in that movie in 1999, it's like as a 14-year-old who like loved every movie with gunfights, I was like, what did these guys do? They were just standing in this building and like now they're all getting murdered. And so I feel like there's a part of this that is really earning the fact that every single person who dies in this movie gets what they deserve. And I think that's part of what the movie's doing really well is making you think about that, of making you think about like, could people get out of this? Is there a way out of this situation? And saying, no, there isn't.
Yeah. Talking with you, it's really interesting how much it's sort of about that honor too, like, because the villains throughout the movie is like tend to be the people who have broken the unwritten rules or the written rules of the world. Like when the young mobster comes and beats the shit out of John Wick, the issue is not that he went and beat the shit out of a random person, it's that he went and beat the shit out of one of us, right? Like one of the assassins, you know, someone who belongs to our world. And then like later in the movie, you know, you're not allowed to kill people at the special assassins hotel, the Continental, and one of the main like sidekick villains of the movie becomes this assassin who is willing to kill people because she's only in it for money. She's not in it for the honor. I guess I don't know why John is in this in the fucking first place.
I do wonder.
Like, I mean, he got out, you know, but like,
I have a question about this. This is my big question about the movie. And then we should start talking about games, but what is her plan? What is her game plan? Obviously she's just in it for the money. She doesn't care about the rules. How does she think she's getting out of this one?
Well, they haven't like established that this is a global organization yet in the franchise, right? Like maybe this is just like the New York scene, right? Maybe she can just like fuck off to Europe and be fine. And but who knows? I think once you build out the world of the franchise, there's no plan that makes sense anymore. But like in this, we just don't know how local this the rules.
Because it does feel very small. Just, like, I think in a way that's very satisfying.
Yeah, like it feels like the New York ring.
Yeah. Well, and even Michael Nyquist as like the mob boss, he feels like powerful, like he has a lot of connections and a lot of resources, but he doesn't feel like he has infinite connections and infinite resources in the way that a lot of these bad guys sometimes do in like a superhero movie.
Okay, so I want to get to the thing I've been trying to say forever, and then hopefully we can transition this back into the game stuff. But so I think audiences really watched John Wick and took away the wrong thing of like what makes this movie awesome. Like I think a lot of people really latched onto the texture of the thing, the weird gold pirate coins that they like trade around, you know, the like the mythos, like the implication of this like wider world of professional assassins and like all of that. And like we're like, that's what's cool about this is the world building. And for me, that is like completely the opposite of what is effective about John Wick. For me, the thing that makes this movie work and this genre work is those first 29 minutes, is all that setup and the setup of the character, the motivations, that feeling of like chess match thing you were going on, the fact that this world is populated by like the best cameos of all time, just like everyone is going to be like an important person. We're never going to meet a civilian, right? Like every single person other than John Wick's dead wife is involved in this world, right? Like the fact that honor is super important, like those are that's the foundation that everything else then gets to get built on top of. And yeah, the pirate coins, fucking dope as hell, right? Like they're really cool. Like I love that kind of stuff. The fact that you can't kill anyone at Continental Grounds, it's cool. It implies this like larger thing, but that's texture on top of the like building blocks of the solidness that makes this work.
You have triggered my trap card.
Yeah, let's go.
Because this is a thing that I agree with you on this fully. And I think there's a thing that has happened that is like, I'm gonna be an old man shouting at clouds now. But but I think what you're describing is something that is very common, maybe increasingly common, which is people really liking something and latching onto something in a movie and having this feeling, or any kind of story, and feeling, having this feeling of, I want more of that, and thinking that the answer to that feeling is to get more of that. And so you see it, like Star Wars is to me the classic example of the beauty of Star Wars is, and this is to your point about the world building, you walk into any room in Star Wars and there's just like a whole world implied in that, you know, the Mos Eisley Cantina. Who's that guy
yeah. with his weird head? Like, what's he doing?
And you think, I want to know about, like, you see it and there's so much going on here. I want to know about all these characters. And then the answer is you do not want to know about all these. Whatever answer they give you is going to be unsatisfying and boring and too much.
It takes away the sense of wonder yeah. that comes from the, like, lack of an answer.
Right. And it's not just world building. It's also like a lesson that I learned when I was writing a murder mystery web series a while ago, and I was learning a lot about murder mysteries. And the thing that I learned was you always kill off a character like right before they get boring. When you as the author know that they have no more story left, but it's not like it's not obvious to everyone else yet. And so what happens is that character gets killed off. The audience is like, oh, man, I love that character. I could have stayed with them forever. And what you, the author, know is that actually if they'd stuck around for even like one more chapter, you would have been so bored of them. And I remember talking about that in the context of Game of Thrones a lot, because Game of Thrones was often really good at that. And people were like, they're going to kill off Tyrion. And I was like, they're never going to kill off Tyrion, because there's no version of the show that is more interesting with Tyrion dead than Tyrion alive. Meanwhile, Alfie Allen, to bring it back to John Wick, you could kill them off three seasons earlier. That was one that they kind of missed.
My dearest listener, have I got a secret for you? Bridgerton is an improvised comedy podcast inspired by the stories of Jane Austen that tells the tale of a wealthy family's secrets, scandals, and shenanigans. Lady Bridgerton has unwed daughters, nosy neighbors, awful country cousins, and now a body to hide. Will the Bridgertons be able to keep their secrets off the pages of Lady Bigwither's gossip sheet? Or will her pen skewer their good name forever? Oh, bits, what a predicament. Featuring the voices of Katie Maravich, Iffy Waddyway, Carolyn Page, Alex Songsharp, Brian Flaherty, and Cassie Wilson, plus a dance card filled with guest comedians of the very finest quality. But for us to help the seeds of rumor ripen into the juicy plum of scandal, we'll need your help. Bridgerton is heading to Kickstarter on June 13th. Go to Bridgerton.com to pre-save the campaign and help us bring this story to life. Ta-ta for now.
What does this have to do with games? Should we talk about games?
Yeah. So let's talk about games. Genre emulation as a games thing. So there's so much of making story games in particular where people are really excited about doing genre emulation or about taking a piece of media like John Wick and like being like, how would this be a game? There's a new podcast. It's Seda and Jess Levine. And the premise of the show is we have someone on, they bring a piece of media, and then we talk about how would this be a game. I think the podcast is called How Would This Be a Game? I'm not positive, but we'll put a look at the show notes. But like, people really want to do that thing, right? So it's complicated to do that thing. You were just saying we should define genre emulation as a term. So what does genre emulation mean to you?
So I think in the context of games, it's basically this idea that a certain game is recreating the tropes and themes of a given genre so that, you know, if you play a game that is doing genre emulation, then what will come out of that game session or that game campaign or whatever is something that resembles to your satisfaction the piece of media that it is inspired by. So like, I'm most well known for Escape from Dino Island, and people are always calling that Jurassic Park of the game. And the idea being that like you play a session of Escape from Dino Island, and what comes out of that is basically your own personal Jurassic Park movie.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons people want to do that, right? Like I look at John Wick and like the tone of it, we talked about the tone to some extent, but the tone of it is so clean and clear. And like the aesthetics of it, even outside of the like cool mythological world building feeling that I might want to capture at the table, I also just want to capture the like font of the subtitles, you know? Like I want to capture the like cinematography, which is gorgeous, you know? I want to, like, the fighting your way through two dozen guys in, like, a nightclub with techno music going is so cool and, like, has such a look to it and gives you such a specific feeling that, like, I want to capture that feeling at the table in gameplay. And I think people often in game design are then approaching that from the angle we were kind of talking about before with media of like coming in from the texture rather than coming in from the fucking structure and the bones of the thing that we were talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think I get it. I'll just lay my cards on the table right now early. So when I try to be very charitable about the idea of genre emulation in games, the thing that makes sense to me is movies are very expensive to make. Video games are very difficult to make. They require a lot of people with a lot of skills. Often a lot of capital is invested in these media. And so you or I cannot go out and make a John Wick. And so I understand this feeling of, I want more John Wick. I want to make my own John Wick. I have only hammers. And my hammer is a tabletop role-playing game design. And so I am going to turn John Wick into a nail. And, you know, I get that. Like, I support that because I think it's a beautiful thing to make your own art. I have played a long campaign of Masks, which resulted in some superheroes that, you know, you've never heard of them. Most everyone in the world has never heard of them. But to me, they like matter as much as Spider-Man. And that's cool. And so I respect that. But I also think that it can be a very limiting approach to game design. And also, even when it is a sort of noble goal in its own right, I think it's something I wish people attacked with a little more rigor and more thoughtfully. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think how I feel is that it's sometimes like, I want to do more John Wick. I want to capture John Wick. I want to take John Wick and like put it at the table. But that's also inherently, it's turning game design into trying to be a movie in a way that like movies are good at different things than games, right? Like when you try to go out and capture the exact feeling and experience that you had in another medium through gaming, like I think you often, you're striving for this thing that is less suited to the medium that you're then working in, right?
And that cuts both ways, by the way. Like you look at a lot of the early comic book movies, like Ang Lee's Hulk or the Zack Snyder Watchmen. And these are these movies that are trying very hard to take the textures and sort of vibes of comics,
yeah,
and apply them to movies. And it doesn't work at all. It like totally backfires. And so I think, you know, it's not just that games can't be a movie. It's that a movie can't be a comic. It's a comic can't be an album. Every medium has things that it can do really well, things that it struggles with. And so I think, yeah, to your point, where I always start when I'm thinking about this is, what makes this a role-playing game? And that's even if I started from a place of, I love John Wick and I want to make a John Wick inspired game.
Yeah.
I'm like, what is my John Wick role playing game? Which I'm curious to ask you, what is a John Wick role playing game, Sam?
Yeah. Well, I want to bring in something else before we get to Band-Aids and bullet holes. I can't believe how much of this episode has gone by without, sure, me talking about Band-Aids, yeah, and bullet holes, but we'll really bring it in here in the end. But I want to bring in the classic, like, Powered by the Apocalypse thing, because a lot of people have said that Powered by the Apocalypse in particular is like a system for genre emulation. And there's like so many things that I find wrong about that sentence. But I do think that, I'm not going to name names here, but I do think that there was a long period where a lot of the games, the like main PBTA canon that was coming out was just trying to like make an engine to emulate a particular genre. And I think that a lot of those games really lacked a certain specificity to them. I heard some fucking podcast recently where Thomas Manuel was talking about this. I can't remember whether it was one of the Rascal Book Club things that he's doing or on Yes Indeed, but there was, I want to say it was the episode, the second episode he did on Apocalypse World that included a conversation with Luke and Lynn Cadega, Luke Jordan and Lynn Cadega, in which Luke and Thomas in particular were talking about how games like Monster of the Week, games like I think a lot of the some of the early Magpie games like fell into this a little bit. It's like they're having this conversation about, you know, you take like Monster of the Week, and Monster of the Week like is a game where you can almost fill in the game with the player's understanding of the genre. Right? That like the game just kind of like falls away. The game can be patched over with our understanding of how the genre works at the table and how that's not like, then what's the game bringing? You know, like the game is bringing like something kind of halfway. But like if a lot of what the game is asking you to do is sort of draw the rest of the owl via filling the bucket with the tropes that you understand the genre to contain, like that's not what games are best at, I feel like, you know, I think you can do right. better than that.
Well, and I have so many, you're making me think so many different things, but finish your thought.
Sorry. And one more thing before I turn it back to you is like the thing that Vincent Baker has always said about the idea of PBTA as genre emulation is that he does not consider his games to be emulators of genres. He considers them to be entries into genres. And I think that is a much better way of handling this, right? Like Apocalypse World, to me, as much as I might pitch it to people as the like Mad Max Fury Road, the RPG, like actually what it is a different entry for telling a different kind of post-apocalyptic story that maybe shares some aesthetic qualities that I can use to get people in the door with Mad Max, but which is really standing on its own. It's bringing its own specificity. It's bringing its own thing. You could easily make a different post-apocalyptic game, like Dream Askew, for example, that has a different set of aesthetics and feels like a different entry into the genre. I feel like that's a much more productive way of looking at the whole thing.
I find that completely unhelpful to me personally. I'm glad it works for other people, and I think it's helpful in the sense of disrupting this idea of PBTA as something that emulates genre and giving, like, letting PBTA and games more generally kind of have value as opposed to be this sort of secondary art form. So I, you know, respect to Vincent. And I think if you think about it, I guess in the context of like, you know, the My Chemical Romance album Danger Days is like an album that is a post-apocalyptic album, right? Sure. And so like, if you think of an album being able to be post-apocalyptic and what that looks like versus Mad Max being post-apocalyptic, then I guess I can see how a game is also in that genre. But I think there's something that is true about games because they are often defined by rules or by, you know, prompts or whatever you, however you build a role-playing game, that I think they have this element inherent to them that is sort of critical mode. You know, like there is something true. And I can't believe I'm saying this because I was just the guy saying that, or I don't think PBTA should be like pigeonholed as a genre emulating tool. But there is something true about a move at its core is like if you're making a game about a genre and you put a move in and the move says every time this thing comes up, it's going to work like this. What you're making is a statement about this is how this genre works, which is different from when, you know, Mad Max has the Doof Warrior come out with his electric guitar. That's just a cool thing that's happening. But it's not saying that every time someone shows up, they're going to play an electric guitar, right? Like, there's a sense in which sort of both things are true. But I also think that there's a sense in which the literal content of the move matters a lot. And I think a lot of the PBTA games that we sort of chafe at from a genre emulation perspective, like on Monster of the Week or whatever, which, you know, I'm very happy that people love Monster of the Week. It's not a game that moves me. And I think the reason that it doesn't move me, even though I like a lot of the media that it's based on, I was an X-Files kid forever, is that I think a lot of what those moves are doing is very literal. It's very surface. It's like when you search you might find this, this, or this. And those are the kinds of things that you find. And for me, where the PBTA moves really come alive in their relationship to genre is when they're functioning more on the level of theme, or they're
almost like it's more interesting in some ways when like they're describing the physics of the narrative rather than the physics of the like physics.
Exactly.
You know? Like how, what are the like rules of how this kind of story functions and tumbles forward?
Right. And you can do that in a lot of different ways. So like, I'll talk a little bit about Escape from Dino Island, I guess, because it's the game that I made. So it in some ways embodies my feelings about this better than just talking about it in the abstract. But one of the things that we did was we created the basic moves and all the player facing moves in a way that they basically allow you, if you want, to not adopt an authorial stance at all. So basically you can play Escape from Dino Island, a PBTA game, just in the mindset of, my character is looking around, they're seeing a dinosaur, like what do I think they want to do next? And all of the choices you're asked to make are choices that that character might reasonably be asked to make in those moments. And so what a lot of those moves end up doing is forcing these questions of, am I going to help other people? Am I going to help myself? And I think more than asking whether a dinosaur is going to jump out or not, is something that kind of makes it feel more like that genre, not because it's kind of mirroring the tropes, but because it's making you think and feel the things that you think and feel when you're engaging with that genre.
We got to talk about Band-Aids and bullet holes. So you asked like 15 minutes ago or some shit, like what makes a John Wick game for me? And, you know, so I've made this John Wick game. It's called Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. It's on Kickstarter. Everyone should go check it out. Go pay for it. I just want you to play it. Just play the game. Just go play the game. But to me, what makes a John Wick game, I think I was very clear about this. This is the third time I'm saying it. It's that like foundation. It's the load-bearing walls of the house of the setup, the first act of John Wick, the movie. It's characters who exist in this world and have vendettas. They have relationships with each other. Those relationships are a mix of owing each other debts, literally owing each other debts for like reasons of honor, maybe, just maybe, owing each other debts because they like each other and are friends, or like have been vulnerable with each other, you know, and that someone is going to become a wrecking ball inside a like community of people who are all like that with each other. And that wrecking ball is then gonna go like slam into everyone like they're a pinball bumper, and everyone is going to have to react. Everyone is going to have to start taking sides, calling in their own favors, going to higher ground, trying to stay out of it, whatever the thing is that they're going to do. Those are the things that are really important to me about a John Wick game. So the way that I accomplished that in Bandits and Bullet Holes was with this mechanic called a powder keg. So a powder keg is like a scenario, right? So one of them is called Dead Mentor. And it's like Sam Roberts and Sam Dunnewald were both mentees of Sam Tung. And Sam Tung has been murdered horribly recently. And I'm convinced that Sam Roberts was behind it because you never liked him. And so I'm going to come and fuck your shit up. And the first thing that I'm going to do is go to Lady Tabletop and be like, you need to help me fuck up Sam Roberts now. And she's going to be like, I don't want to do that. We're buds. And I'm going to be like, tough, you got to pick sides. And like, that's the drama. That's what John Wick is about. And, you know, so then there's this whole procedure for setting scenes. And the scene setting procedure is very much like, I have to pick a character that I'm going to play as, and I have to say what they want and who they want it from. And that scene framework, did a whole episode about this. I don't know what order these are coming out in. So either it's coming soon or it just happened with Vidicia Violetti, about how I originally started this game as like a Firebrands framework, and it all collapsed down into like one scene. There's just only one scene, and it's that one. You want something from someone, and they don't want to give it to you. Like, that is maybe the foundational unit of John Wick to me. It's like, you want something from a person, they don't want to give it to you. You can resort to your baser instincts, you can resort to violence, or you can try to negotiate, how's it going to go down? Like, that's fundamentally what the game is about. And so then on top of all of that is this mechanic of calling cards. And calling cards, every character in this game is a little deck of cards. Lady Tabletop and Serafina did a whole episode about these, so you can go listen to that and talk or hear about calling cards. But the basic idea is you take a playing card, you write some cool evocative trait on there, like a nail gun or a toothy grin or bisexual lighting. Those are my three things. Maybe John Wick has like grief over his wife and dog and a bulletproof suit and guns, lots of guns, right? And now when I show up and I'm fighting with you, I'm gonna like take these cards and shuffle them up and flip one over and we'll like play war and see who's got the higher calling card. But the like fun part of those things, I don't actually care about the game of war. Like that is fun. And it is fun then to be like, oh, okay, my toothy grin beat your nail gun. What is that? You're like shooting nails at me and I'm just like smiling at you and making you increasingly agitated. And like, that's a cool beat of the fight, right? But like the fun part was writing those things. Like the calling cards are like a container for all of that energy that I think people have coming into a genre like this, into the John Wick thing of like, I want to talk about the pirate coins. I want to talk about the cool bisexual lighting. Like, I want to talk about all the aesthetic details that are many people's way into the thing. Calling cards are this mechanic that just like soaks up all of that energy. It like allows people to do that part of the genre emulation in whatever way they want to do it. Like, it lets them make up their own details, bring their own version of John Wick to the thing. You can bring their cyberpunk version of it to the game, right? Or their Toontown version of it to the game, or whatever they want to do, while the powder keg is not mutable. Like, I've done the powder keg underneath. That's not something I'm expecting the players to bring. That's the laws of the world. The scene framing, though, you always wanting someone from another character, those are the rules, the foundation, the important parts that really make the genre, along with this like flexible texture that can look like whatever you want on top of it. And that is, to me, what a John Wick game looks like.
I love that. I've been nodding my head, which doesn't really translate on a podcast, but I promise you I was doing it many, many times. But I think what I love about that is the way you describe it so mirrors the way we were talking about the movie in just like a structural way, which is that like the calling cards, for those of you who don't know about the game, it is literally a game of war. Like, Sam was not being facetious when he said that. Like, it's literally
the classic card game war,
right?
Yeah.
And so you could play that game entirely without the calling cards, with them just being the nine of hearts or whatever, and the game would function and the stakes would be just as high, because the mentor would still be dead and Sam would still be coming for me. And what I love about that is that to my point earlier, because I was really smart before when I said this, that it's, in a sense, this is a piece of criticism, right? That you're a film criticism that you have created on one level about the John Wick movie. And the idea that what really matters at the end of the day is that someone wants something from someone else and they're going to get it one way or the other. And all of that stuff, the bisexual lighting, the cool fonts, the soundtrack that sounds like it came out of Y2K era, like all of that stuff is just the icing on the cake. You're saying that stuff that a lot of people think is important is actually so unimportant that you could get rid of it and the game would work and the story would work fine. But then you add it in and stuff is the stuff that makes it interesting. Right. And so,
because what would a cake be without frosting?
Exactly.
Right. Like, are we really going to just shovel frosting into our mouths? Like, we know something's missing there. Like, I would rather have the substantial cake in there. But like, a cake wants frosting, too. Yeah. Like, you do want the aesthetic.
The frosting is what makes every cake distinctive. Right. And I think when you do that right in a game that exists in a genre, when you do that right, That's what it feels like. It feels like you have created your own awesome cake or your own awesome John Wick movie. And when you do it poorly, you still get something that like it feels like you have made a copy of a John Wick movie. You've hit all the beats of a John Wick movie, but you haven't quite actually made your own John Wick story or John Wick experience. Because I think experience is kind of a better way of thinking about this even than story. I like don't believe that games need to have stories, although a lot of these genre, like kind of when you're emulating the genre.
We can't do 90 minutes on whether games have stories.
No, but I think in this case they do. And so that was one thing I was definitely going to bring up, which was this idea of the foundation and the...
I have another thing I wanted to say too. So another thing that's interesting to me, just like saying all this out loud and talking through the movie, is I'm realizing how much for me, John Wick is a movie about that building of tension. That like before every fight scene in John Wick, there is this period of building of tension. I love this one. You know, the nightclub scene is so iconic in John Wick. But the thing that happens before the nightclub scene that like makes it for me is he like, we're with like a guy who's hanging around as a guard outside the nightclub. And suddenly there's a gun to the back of his head. And he's like, oh, you could see it in his eyes. And John Wick says, "Hey, Marty," or whatever his name is. And the guy goes, "John, you're back?" And like, you know, they have a little conversation and John's like, "You want to take the rest of the night off?" And the guy's like, "Yeah, I think I'll take the rest of the night off." And like, you know, then John Wick sneaks into the building and like kills a million guys, right? And there's like more building of tension. We like learn the layout of the place and all that kind of crap. But like that scene, it's all build and then the little release of the guy, but we keep going with the build with John into the thing. And like for Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, in a 2.5 hour session, there's like one fight scene that takes 15 minutes, typically, maybe two. But like there's so many few fights. There's so much less time spent on the fights than in like a movie, in John Wick, in an action sequence, because I don't think those fights translate interestingly to tabletop in the same way, right? Like even the fights in Band-Aids and Bullet Holes are so much about pulling details of calling cards and combining them into like one little creative moment, as opposed to the like ballet of John killing 24 guys in a nightclub. And like there's this mechanic in the duels of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes where you spend a lot of time like taking every one of your calling cards and like setting it in the scene to like build up the tension of like, how are things going here? And some people don't like this because it like bumps. Like sometimes it doesn't make sense to like set a particular calling card in the scene and it can be bumpy. But when it works, it's like half of a duel is just the like, like we get the shot of the hand over the gun, right? The tumbleweed blows past, you know, we get all that, like those building up of details before the release of the thing. And to, like the whole game of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is about that buildup until the one release of a fight, a climactic fight at the end. And that feels different to me. That's something I have changed in my entry into this genre.
I actually think, I'm glad you said that, because I think that's like one of the, like if we want to talk about like really practical game design, like techniques that I think you can learn from this. I think that kind of pacing is something that tabletop role-playing games do really well. If you're trying to translate or adapt, I think is a better, rather than emulate, if you're trying to adapt something from one media, especially a like a film or a narrative media into games, I think one of the things that you're going to struggle with is pacing, right? A movie has a soundtrack, it has an editor, and like when you're sitting down to play a tabletop game, you're like fumbling over rules, you're talking to people, you're like, you know, negotiating the fiction, the fictional positioning, and you're just never going to get that ballet that sound that you were just talking about. But I do think the thing that you can do really well is do all that stuff, the fictional positioning, the negotiating the rules, getting all of these things in place until you have one thing that happens. You know, in D&D, it's the to hit roll, right? Or the damage roll or whatever it is. Like D&D is really good at that, in that there's always a moment in a D&D game where everyone is looking at that die to see what happens. And like the fate of everyone rests on whether that's a 12 or a 13. And if you can figure out, like, so like I've been working slowly but surely on a car racing game based on the video game Wipeout, which is a game that like I love. And like you cannot do Wipeout as it exists in a tabletop role-playing game, because that game is all about speed and a throbbing techno music. And those are two things that role-playing games don't do well. And so the way I've been thinking about it is like when I'm playing a racing video game or when I'm like going really fast, when I'm like skiing, you know, a lot of times you're just like zooming around, you're kind of like maintaining stuff, you're holding the line, and then every now and then there's like a moment where things kind of feel like they go into slow motion, right? And you're like, this is the moment where maybe I'm going to pass this guy, but maybe I'm going to wipe out. And so when I'm working on this game that I still haven't quite cracked, it's like the game is just like you're flipping over cards and then something happens and we pause and we do a bunch of stuff and then we resolve it. And that to me has that moment of like that I felt in real life, that visceral moment of slowing down, of being in this really intense crucible for a second. And then whoop, we speed back into full speed, which also happens in movies and stuff too. And so if you can figure out how to do something like that in your game that plays to the pacing strength, or like to the way that the games are naturally kind of paced and the strengths of that pacing, you're going to get something good out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the classic, like making any piece of art to me, I think it is really helpful to come back to the question again and again and again, like, what do you want the audience to feel? And I think adaptation from one medium to another is so much about how do you maintain that feeling in the new medium. That, like, for me, the thing about John Wick that I love, that I want people to feel, is that tension between, am I going to resort to my baser instincts? Am I going to throw my life away for revenge? Am I going to ruin this friendship because it will get me closer to punishing someone evil? Like, am I going to make that hard decision and the build up to that? Like, that to me is the excitement of John Wick. And I've adapted that. Like, that's the feeling that you get in Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. And you do it in a completely different way. And in the same, like, I'm excited to play your racing game because that feeling in real life of like zooming is really cool. And I totally have felt that way at the table before. But how do you capture it in a game? Like, you just have to try different things. You can't just like put a list of cool cards in your game, you know? We incidentally, we really, really got to wrap this up, but I'll give you the last word. Go for it.
Yeah. So another practical technique that I think is like super helpful in this regard is, and it's very, very unexpected, is I think to just like see what happens if you get rid of all of the rules that are enforcing genre. Because I think that, like, you know, if you're sitting, like, it'll always happen that someone at the table has never seen John Wick or any movies that were based on John Wick or were inspired John Wick. But like, probably most of the people who are sitting down to play Band-Aids and Bullet Holes or whatever, they like kind of know what they're in for and what they want to do. So like, you don't need to tell them to play like a cool badass assassin or like make rules that are going to make them push them to play a cool badass assassin. That's the stuff that they're going to do kind of naturally. And so instead you can use your, like, the cognitive load you have in your rules to like do things that they wouldn't necessarily do, that they don't want to do. You know, like, can you make your character do embarrassing things or vulnerable things with these rules? Or can you help them, you know, I know this was something like you were working on, Sam, right? About like reasons to, like, good reasons to say no, because that's a part that's actually a pain point for people, even when they know that what they're supposed to do is say, absolutely not, John Wick, I'm not going to help you. Why do they do that? And how? What kind of scaffolding they need to actually come up with a good explanation can be kind of hard. And so I think embrace the idea of getting rid of some rules that you actually don't need, because we know these genres. That's part of the strength of a genre, is you don't need to explain what a detective is every time you make a detective story.
Yeah. I want to leave people with some homework, maybe something we didn't really get into, but that I'm really interested in right now, is kind of exactly what you were talking about of like, does what happens to your game when you strip away as much as possible and like still have it try to be like, is it still genre? Like, what's the minimum viable amount of game that is like recognizably in a genre? And I'd be really interested in approaching it from the other direction too, of like, Jeff Stormer has a podcast right now called
Bump in the Night.
Batman Bump in the Night, in which he and his co-host, whose name I do not recall at the moment, are doing just pure improvised Batman storytelling, right? They're just making up their own Batman stuff, and then that's it. That's the podcast, right? And like, there are, on the one hand, like, no rules. And on the other hand, there are so many rules. Like, there are so many implicit rules in the genre of Batman, or at least what those two people's understanding of Batman is, and that's what they're using to play. And I think it is really interesting to think about, is that still a game? I think yes, but like, it, look, what is going on there exactly? Like, what do you need to make your game? Like, what can you like leave up to people's expectations that they're bringing in? And where are the pain points where like you're trying to do something different from what people's expectations are, bringing in whatever they believe about the genre that they believe your game to be? And like, how are you going to push them aside from those things? I think all of that's really interesting. Batman Bump in the Night.
Yeah, you don't need any rules. You don't need any rules to be Batman. So then what do you need rules for?
Exactly, exactly.
Can I give one piece of homework too?
Yeah.
I have a friend of mine who used to have a saying, and it was, this was back when hipsters were a thing. Oh yeah, a hipster? Those are those people who are just like me and my friends, except they're shitty.
The idea
is that there's like... it's very hard to do, like, and I feel that way about genre emulation. Like, I'm like, oh, I hate genre emulation, but then also I love lots of games that are genre emulating, and I make a lot of games that are genre emulating. And I think a good piece of homework also, because why not give you two pieces of homework, is to actually like make a list of like, which are the games that are genre emulating that you think are really cool, and which are the games that are genre emulating that you think are like really dopey, and see what the commonalities are, and what is actually working for you for the ones that work, and what isn't working for you, because I think it'll be a little different for all of us. I know it's probably a little different for you and me, Sam, but like, I think that's how you'll figure out your way to explore genre as a game designer.
Sam Roberts, thanks for coming back on Dice Exploder.
My pleasure. I'm so glad we finally solved genre emulation once and for all.
Thanks again to Sam for being here. Run Don't Walk to Kickstarter and back Bandits and Bullet Holes today. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder, and you can find my games at sdunwall.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporgery, our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy Travis Tesmer. This episode was edited by Emma Costa, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next week.